You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the editor of the Washington Post's Fact Checker about fact-checking President Biden and how things compare to the Trump administration. Now, state Republicans gaveled into a special session of the legislature called by Governor Evers yesterday to consider expanding the state's Medicaid program and promptly gaveled back out. The Assembly and Senate both adjourned after less than a minute each. By turning down federal money to make more people eligible for Badger Care, lawmakers rejected a $1 incentive that's being offered to the 12 states that have yet to go through with Medicaid expansion since 2014. State Democrats have repeatedly pushed the issue. Republican leaders, though, say it could drive up the cost of private plans and ultimately saddle the state with too much spending in the future, especially if federal commitments go down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the state accept money to expand the Medicaid program here? Are you in a spot where you'd be eligible for Badger Care if it was expanded? If so, would you do that? Are you currently on Badger Care or have you been in the past? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back. I don't know if we have Laurel. We'll keep trying. In just a few moments, we'll also be talking to a UW expert on health care and funding. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think the state should take the federal money to expand Badger Care here in the state? Or do you think that ultimately we had the right decision soon after the Affordable Care Act was passed in not taking that extra Medicaid money from the federal government? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll bring Laurel White on hopefully in just a moment. Here she is. Laurel, hi. Sorry we lost you.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
All right. What happened yesterday with this, what ended up being a very short special session?
So Republicans continued their opposition to the Medicaid expansion. This is something they've talked about for several years now, opposing this. It was first offered in 2014. They really haven't changed their tune, but Governor Evers kind of tried to amp up the debate, called the special session. Republicans pushed back and said, nope, we're not even going to come to the floor. We're just going to gavel in, gavel out.
So there was no argument on the floor, but there were arguments, I think, from the sidelines from both sides. What, first of all, have we heard from Governor Evers and Democrats as they make the case that, hey, now's a good time to do this?
Well, you know, aside from the arguments that they make about expanding Medicaid to about 90,000 people at this point would be eligible under the expansion by raising the income cap, and the sort of healthcare savings that they say would be associated with that because of, you know, putting more money up front, preventative care, not paying for emergency room visits that folks can't foot the bill for themselves. They talk about this $1 billion sweetener that's coming from the federal government for states that haven't taken the expansion yet. And they say, we really can't pass this up. This is a lot of money and really helpful now as we're recovering from the pandemic.
And on the Republican side, these are similar arguments, apart from that $1 billion bonus that we've heard from Democrats all along the way. Republicans, what's been their argument?
Well, their primary argument is that there isn't really a coverage gap in Wisconsin, that the folks that would be eligible under the expansion already have access to affordable health care on the private marketplace in the state. So there really isn't a need there in their argument. And they say that this could increase costs, and that it could actually, in the biggest part of their argument, saddle Wisconsin with more money, more spending down the road if the federal government kind of walks back some of its commitments to paying for Medicaid, or enrollment is bigger than expected, costs balloon for the state based on the number of people that sign up for this. They just don't want to get involved in that and take that risk.
And this all comes in the midst of the state setting up a new budget. Governor Evers, I believe, had assumed this Medicaid acceptance happening in the state budget and factored that into his numbers. What happens to his budget ideas without that?
He absolutely did. And that's a huge amount of revenue. I mean, that $1 billion sweetener alone, a huge amount of money, the other money that's coming in, aside from the sweetener that has to do with Medicaid. But this isn't unusual. The governor included a lot of revenue proposals that Republicans have taken out. He proposed legalizing marijuana in Wisconsin and taxing it and taking the revenue from that. So what we're really seeing in budget negotiations is Republicans departing in a big way from what the governor has proposed and kind of starting from their own sort of square one in terms of this is the money that we have to spend and this is how we're going to spend it.
Laurel, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thanks, Rob.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She got us up to speed on yesterday's special session of the legislature to consider Medicaid expansion with federal money. Republicans adjourned in less than a minute. Now we're taking a look at the impact this could have on Wisconsinites. Donna Friedsam is a researcher and the health policy programs director at UW-Madison's Institute for Research on Poverty. Donna, welcome back to Central Time. And not hearing Donna now. We'll get her on the line. In the meantime, I'll remind you that you can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think the state should accept this Medicaid money? Let's bring on a caller or two while we reconnect with our guest. Let's start off with Randy in Portage. Randy, hi.
Yes, hi. I'm a former Badger Care recipient, as is my daughter. And unfortunately, it's very emotional, but without Badger Care, I would not have my daughter. The state saved her life. And how these Republicans can be so horrible and not expand this is beyond my comprehension. The state saved her. She's a steady worker. She's never been unemployed. She was a good student. She's nearing 30 years old now. Contributes to society, has a good paying job, house, pays taxes on her income, pays property taxes. The state doesn't see the big picture here, how saving one person can contribute more to society than just their shortfall and short vision in what they're doing.
Randy, thanks for calling in. I'm glad your daughter ended up being okay. Sounds like a rough time. Thanks for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. As we talk about Medicaid expansion in Wisconsin, not happening, at least for now. Donna Friedsam is on the line. Sorry we lost you there, Donna. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Well, can you remind us of a little bit of the history? Wisconsin did something different than most other states soon after the Affordable Care Act under the Walker administration. We didn't take that federal expansion money. We moved some people off of Badger Care, saying that they could get onto the marketplace, but expanded Badger Care to some people who hadn't been previously able to get into it. Can you remind us of the unique course we plotted here?
That's exactly right. We actually previously had expanded Medicaid under Governor Doyle such that parents and caretaker adults had coverage beyond the Affordable Care Act's existing eligibility limits, and that started in 2008. But childless adults or adults who do not have dependent children did not have that coverage. So when the Affordable Care Act came in, Governor Walker decided that he could remove that Medicaid eligibility for the parents and caretaker adults, moved about 75,000 of them off of Medicaid coverage and told them to seek coverage under the Affordable Care Act marketplace instead, brought that Medicaid eligibility level down to 100% of the federal poverty level, which is lower than the Affordable Care Act standard for eligibility. At the same time, though, the state opened up eligibility for childless adults, again, adults without dependent children. So you may have had children at some point in your life, but they've aged out of dependency. So all adults became eligible up to what we call 100% of the federal poverty level, which is about $12,500 for an individual. Currently in the state, it's actually $12,800 for an individual annually, or for a family of four, it's $26,500 a year.
So the big question again, then in the years that have passed, Donna, those families that had been eligible but weren't, and the idea Governor Walker and others said was, that's okay, because now we have the federal exchange and subsidies from the federal government. They're not going to be left out in the cold. Do we know what has panned out for that group of people?
Right. So my research team actually is completing has completed a study on that. That group of people were called the transitioners, and we're actually in the process of putting out results about that right now, and have found that most of the people that lost the coverage back in 2014 did not find their way to other coverage, and many of them became uninsured. And a couple of years later, most of them ended up either uninsured or back on Medicaid. So it did not turn out that those people were able to find the wherewithal to take up coverage in the private sector or through the marketplace as had been intended, unfortunately.
If they ended up back on Medicaid, I assume that means their income went back down to that threshold?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now we've got this talk, never-ending talk, about the idea of taking federal money plus a little bonus here of $1 billion. What would accepting that federal money and expanding to that old threshold again, what would that mean in Wisconsin today?
So what that would allow is for people in that that margin between the 100% eligibility that we have in Wisconsin and what the Affordable Care Act specifies, which is up to 138% of the federal poverty level, that group that currently does not have eligibility for Medicaid, it would allow them to enroll in Medicaid coverage. So that would be the parents and caretaker adults who previously lost coverage, and that would also include the childless adults that today don't have that coverage. So that would be about what is estimated to be about the 90,000 people that would gain eligibility for Medicaid coverage. Now, recognize that there is today about 40,000 people in that, of those 90,000, that are indeed covered under the marketplace, have taken up coverage elsewhere. Some of them may have been in Medicaid at some point, some of them may have been somewhere else, but right now today they are enrolled in marketplace coverage, and that is one of the concerns that have been voiced by people who have opposed this Medicaid expansion, is that it's going to take 40,000 people out of the marketplace and move them into Medicaid at the same time that it takes another 40,000 people from the uninsured and puts them into Medicaid.
We're talking to Donna Friedsam, Health Policy Programs Director at UW-Madison's Institute for Research on Poverty, looking at the state legislature rejecting the idea of expanding the state's Medicaid eligibility to include, as she was just saying, about 90,000 more people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the state take the federal money to expand Badger Care or not? And has this affected your life, access to or lack of access to coverage under Medicaid and Badger Care? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Donna Friedsam, health policy expert at the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison, looking at the issue of Medicaid expansion here in the state after Republicans shut down a special session of the legislature on that issue yesterday. Donna Friedsam stays with us, researcher and health policy programs director at UW-Madison's Institute for Research on Poverty, and with you at 800-642-1234. If you have an opinion to share, thoughts on this subject, or questions for our guest, 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Joy is with us in West Bend. Joy, hello.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to mention this. I am a retired nurse. I've worked as a volunteer nurse at a free clinic here in West Bend, and we could see then when people have access to medical care, then they're able to go to work. They're able to pay taxes, so they're able to contribute. I think if the legislators are afraid that private insurance people would have to pay more if we accepted Medicaid expansion, that doesn't make sense. We already pay more because people who don't have insurance and don't have preventative care then have to wait until they have to go for an emergency room, and then we end up paying more for our insurance because they're unable to pay then. And I just can't believe how the legislators, federal or state, can keep refusing to give people access to affordable health care when they have good coverage for themselves and their families.
Joy, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Donna in on this. So what do you think of Joy's thoughts on the kind of the economic impact of people having access to this coverage?
Well, I think Joy is noticing something that is a debate that we see, where what we hear is people who are opposing the expansion are often pointing out that they say, we don't want to put people on a welfare program and keep them from working. But in fact, what we know from studies is that getting people on Medicaid often helps people return to work. It helps them to get the services, the health care coverage they need, and stabilize their finances so that they can work productively. And many of them do work. Many people who are actually on Medicaid are full-time and part-time employed. In fact, almost 70% of people who are on Medicaid are working productively, but they don't get health insurance through their employers. So it's not that Medicaid is inconsistent with work, and in many ways, Medicaid helps people be actively working. I think that's a difference in the way people consider the Medicaid program, and that people are concerned that it is keeping people out of the workforce.
Thanks for the call, Joy, at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to more of our callers, Donna, one more concern that Republicans have raised is, okay, this might work great for now, but if we're making these commitments at the state level and then the federal money dries up over time, this could have a big impact on the state budget that we would have a really hard time making up for. What are your thoughts on that argument?
Well, you know, I think that it's always reasonable for us, an elected official to be concerned about the current and future of state budgets. And so I can't prognosticate about what will happen at the federal or state level with regard to budgets. But what I can say is this. This was a concern that was noted back in 2010 and 2012 when the legislature was debating the Medicaid expansion, and the federal money did not go away. And so more and more states continued to adopt the Medicaid expansion, recognizing that it was a federal commitment to the program. And it's similar to way back when Medicaid first came along in 1965, and some states were slower to adopt the Medicaid program back then, having these kinds of concerns. And it took Arizona actually like 20, 25 years as a state to take it on. But people pretty much figure out that this is a program that the federal government has made a commitment to and has seen the value in. So I'm not sure we're going to see the federal government step back from its commitment to this program, because at this point, 75 million people in the country rely on this program in order to get access to a basic need service, their health care. And so, I think, it's always a question whenever the state decides to enter into a commitment to building a road, a highway, a school, and take federal money for it, whether they're going to be able to get their federal money next year, what they thought they were going to get, but no more so with the Medicaid program.
Let's go back to our callers now with Gianni in Marquette County. Gianni, hi.
Yes, hello. Enjoying the program. Listen, I am very appreciative of the Affordable Care Act and Badger Care. I've been on it for a number of years now, and let me tell you why I'm on it. I have spent the last 15 years caring for my parents. I had to quit my job in 2016, and I've had exactly 1 week of vacation in the last 15 years. Now, if I had put my parents, if they'd become wards of the state, they don't have a lot of money, put them in a nursing home, what sort of costs would the taxpayers, federal and state, incur from they being in a nursing home? I think the state is getting a real good deal from me.
Johnny, thanks for sharing your experience. So your thoughts, Donna?
I think that there's a lot of people out there who really value their experience with the Medicaid program. And I want to note that the people, you know, you'll hear a lot of those kinds of stories where people are very grateful for their opportunity to participate in the program. That being said, I don't want to delegitimize that the concerns that are being voiced on the other side about the program and increasing participation in the program. That said, as well, I want to, you know, I think it's clear at this point with 38 other states participating and not only blue states, but blue and red states, that there's a large amount of evidence that this program is very good for individuals and families. It's been very good for state budgets. And that, and really at this point, we're not really arguing whether it's a good program or whether it helps people. We're really arguing philosophical differences about what the role is of states and the public sector in health and healthcare.
Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. Donna, just in our last minute or so, this is apparently not going to happen this year. What are you watching for now when it comes to Medicaid and Badger Care in Wisconsin?
You know, I think it's going to be a challenge for the state budget, of course, to work out the details now that it's not going to accept the federal match or the increase in the federal funds, and what how the state is going to address the other healthcare related items that were in the budget that were priorities, I think, for both parties now that it doesn't have those funds available. And so I'll be watching for that. And as well, I'm going to be watching at the federal level for the several healthcare initiatives that are emerging and how our state is going to adjust to potential changes with in as they emerge at the federal level.
Donna, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Donna Friedsam is a researcher and health policy programs director at UW-Madison's Institute for Research on Poverty. Earlier, we talked to WPR reporter Laurel White. They joined us for a look at the state legislature starting and ending a special session of legislature quickly on Medicaid expansion, what the move means for lower-income people here in the state. Coming up, the editor of the Washington Post Fact Checker joins the show to talk about the differences between fact-checking former President Trump and current President Biden. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the president visits Tulsa next week as part of a renewed push to acknowledge the harm done there 100 years ago. Three descendants of survivors of the city's race massacre share their stories today at 6 on 1A+. Now, Donald Trump made 511 false or misleading claims during his first 100 days in office as president. President Biden has made 78. That's according to the Washington Post Fact Checker, which analyzes claims made by politicians and other public figures. It's not just the quantity of falsehoods that's different with the Biden administration. It's also the quality. The fact checker says that Biden's misleading claims are the ones that are more typical with politicians across the board. Obfuscation, fudging the numbers, exaggeration, that sort of thing. We're talking now about fact checking, what it looked like during the Trump era compared to the Biden administration today. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you pay attention to these fact-checking sites at the Washington Post or elsewhere? Does it ever change your opinion about an issue? Do you worry about them? Do you have questions about how it works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We have the editor and chief writer for the Washington Post Fact Checker with us now, Glenn Kessler. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
And Lucas Graves is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison and the author of Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism. Lucas, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Glenn, let's start with you. I mentioned a couple of your first 100-day numbers there. Big picture, what are some of the key differences you've noticed fact-checking the Biden administration as compared to the Trump administration?
Well, first of all, the quantity is much less, in part because President Biden doesn't, he barely ever tweets, and if he does, it's kind of anodyne. whereas the President Trump was constantly tweeting. That was a major source of falsehoods. Biden also gives relatively short speeches. He doesn't give many interviews. He has limited exchanges with reporters. Trump, in his first 100 days, gave longer speeches. He didn't have as many interactions with reporters. That changed over the course of his presidency, where he, in effect, became his own press secretary, and they never did any kind of briefings. So in the Biden era, you have the White House press secretary every day giving a briefing for an hour or so. That's a lot of where the administration's message comes out. And that leaves less room for major errors by the president.
That's a kind of quantity side of things. How about quality? Do you find yourselves again and again doing similar things back in the Trump era versus in the Biden era?
Right. Now, there's also a difference. I mean, Trump, you know, he just shot from the hip. He paid little attention to basic facts. He simply made up stuff half the time. Biden kind of sticks to a script. He might occasionally get himself in trouble if he's speaking, in an interview and throws out a fact that is a little off kilter. But generally, you know, the things he's saying are from prepared speeches, which have already been well vetted. And when we catch him in an error, generally the next day he will stop saying it. Like, his staff will go and fix things. So, whereas in comparison, Trump rarely ever corrected or changed one of his talking points in response to a fact check.
And Lucas, you've studied fact-checking journalism and how it's evolved over the years. What have you seen in the shift, not just with Glenn's outfit, but with fact-checking in general, in the shifting of administrations here?
Well, I would just echo the point that Glenn was making. I mean, what really stood out about Trump, and I think even about the Republican Party under Trump, was the very casual disregard for truth and for, you know, evidence-backed statements by many leading political figures. And so what I heard over and over from fact-checkers like Glenn was that, they'd never been so challenged. I mean, Glenn did this extraordinary job of tracking every falsehood uttered by the president during his one term in office. And that was a really Herculean task. And fact-checkers in general felt like they were just, underwater, and that the pace has returned, maybe not to where it was before 2016, but it's become a bit more normal under the Biden administration. And I'll just add, because I knew that Glenn would quote some figures from the Washington Post, I looked up Trump's average rating on PolitiFact, which is another major fact-checking site, and 73% of the claims that Trump has had checked over the course of his political career or his career, almost 75% were mostly false or worse. And the figure for Biden is just 40%. So that's another view of the sort of stunning difference between them.
Talking about fact checking in the Biden era as compared to the Trump era, Lucas Graves with us from UW-Madison, Glenn Kessler from the Washington Post fact checker, and you at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ken is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Ken, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is, how do you rebut when people basically say that a fact checking site is biased? Meaning that they say, oh, you can't trust those guys. You know, they're owned by the liberals. You know, oh, one of their funders is the Johnson & Johnson or the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, who, you know, is backed by J&J. And so you can't trust what they say about COVID vaccines, et cetera, et cetera. And so I run into that a lot. And I was just wondering if there's a way to kind of either, prove the objectivity and biasness of a site.
Ken, thanks for the call. Glenn, I know people raise concerns and make accusations about bias in fact-checking operations. What would you say to Ken?
Well, what I always tell people that throw that at me is I say, read me for a month every day, and you'll see that we don't play favorites. We're just as tough on one party as the other party. And generally, people come back to me and say, all right, I took your challenge and you were right. You're equally tough on everyone. Because one of the problems is people don't necessarily, you know, log on to the Washington Post/fact checker URL to look at that day's fact check. It ends up in their Facebook feeds, or they see it on Twitter or something like that. And they only see something that might really get them upset, like if I skewer Joe Biden for something that he said. And, you know, and they're not going to see that the next day I skewered Mitch McConnell. So that's why I say, go give us a month. You'll see we are equal opportunity. We go after all people and politicians and advocacy groups of all stripes. No fear or favor.
Thanks for that call, Ken. We'll go to Tom now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was reading a wonderful book by Jason Stanley about how fascism works. And one of the things he talks about is basically repeating the lie until it becomes truth. So how much, like in the Trump administration, do you think it was just someone who just loved the lie and had no regard for the truth? And do you think some of that was actually a strategy where you literally are repeating the lie enough to where you want the public to believe it?
Tom, thanks for the call. Glenn, I'll throw that at you first. I know you mostly focus on checking the facts in front of you at any given moment, but do you have thoughts on what Tom's wondering about whether this was an intentional strategy?
Well, you know, we did catalog more than 30,000 false or misleading claims by President Trump. And it included in that were many, many repeats. Nearly 500 times he said the false claim that he had created the greatest economy in the history of the world. And 300 times he said he passed the biggest fact check ever when it biggest tax cut ever, he only passed the eighth largest. So, you know, but at the same time, Trump tended to believe himself. Now, one reason we were often hesitant to use the word lie was because Trump, he lives in the moment, but if he keeps saying it over and over, I think he convinces himself, and he may have started out thinking, well, I'm just going to exaggerate here. And then in the end, he says it so often, not only is he like convincing his supporters, but he convinces himself. And I think it was particularly the case with the falsehoods about the 2020 election. Now, we did a poll halfway through his term where we asked people whether or not they believed some of his biggest, most frequently said falsehoods. We didn't identify that Trump was the person who said it. We just framed it in a neutral way and asked people pick the right thing. And what we found was most people could identify that what Trump said was false, and that even Trump supporters didn't even believe much of the things that he said. But at the same time, we now see polling that indicates many Republicans believe that he won the election. So that might be a case where that particular falsehood has taken root.
And Glenn, you're going to be leaving us in just a moment. I just wonder, you've been at this a while, whether you're fact-checking a Biden or a Trump or, you know, a thing that people are seeing on the internet, whatever. Do you feel like it's making a difference? Do you get a sense that you're changing people's minds and letting them know that this thing is false and it's working?
Well, you know, we don't write the fact checks to change politicians' behavior, and we don't write the fact checks necessarily to change people's minds. We write the fact checks in order to provide information. What people do with it is up to them. And I, you know, there's lots of social science research out there that shows people are most apt to accept things that confirm what they already believe. So that's a bit of a headwind that we're up against. But the information is out there. I always say I view the fact checks as little paper boats that I put on a stream, and I don't really know what happens to them. And sometimes it clicks with people. Sometimes it doesn't. I just urge people always keep an open mind and be receptive to new information because what you believe may not be correct.
Glenn, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Glenn Kessler, editor-in-chief writer for the Washington Post Fact Checker. Lucas Graves stays with us, author of Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism, as we talk about fact-checking from the Trump administration and how it compares to the Biden administration. You can join in with your thoughts, questions, experiences with fact checks at 800-642-1234. Do you go and seek these things out yourself? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about fact-checking. Lucas Graves is with us, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, author of Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism. You can join in with your thoughts on fact-checking and your experiences with it if you'd like to read them, if they inform you. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Lucas, we just heard from Glenn Kessler. He's not worried about fact-checking if it's going to change politicians' behavior. But is that potentially part of the value? If politicians know they're going to be fact-checked and caught in a lie or a misstatement, maybe that could change their behavior. Is that a part of the potential value here?
That's definitely a part of the value. And you'll often hear fact checkers say that, you know, they don't set out to change anyone's mind or to force politicians to change tune. But at the same time, they're very happy when they have examples of politicians. And this does happen sometimes of politicians who, you know, stop repeating a certain claim when it's been shown to be false. So fact checkers definitely want to make a difference in the world. And one of the ways that they can do that is by raising the costs a little bit for politicians who, you know, who repeat really egregious falsehoods. Of course, there are always politicians who simply pay them no heed. And Donald Trump is probably the most glaring example of that.
Right. Can you talk about in the fact-checking world, former President Trump as kind of an outlier?
He is absolutely an outlier. I mean, there were some precedents, you know, figures, sort of Trumpian figures before he came along and came into office. But the sort of frequency with which he spoke and with which he tweeted, as Glenn pointed out, was really extraordinary. And when you combine the fact that, you know, he was always on TV, he was always talking, always giving interviews, always tweeting, with his just extraordinary disregard for the truth and for the sort of normal standards of evidence-based discourse and for the things that his advisors, you know, were recommending that he say, for sticking to the script, the result is really unusual. I mean, you know, just a barrage of sort of half-truths and, you know, baseless claims and sometimes really extraordinary falsehoods.
Now, I want to talk about how fact-checking is presented. I've seen some concerns about this. Let's make up a false claim. Rob Ferret doesn't like cake. That is a false claim. I want to emphasize this. If my fact-check article says, claim that Rob Ferret doesn't like cake is not true, there's some studies out there that suggest that people are going to still see the keywords. They're going to remember that claim more than they're going to remember the fact-check that says the claim isn't true. How important is it how these things are presented?
It really can make a difference. I mean, the best evidence is that fact checks do have a modest effect in pushing people to abandon false beliefs on average. But the size of that effect varies a lot with presentation. And so, for instance, one thing you don't want to do is repeat the false claim in the headline. It's much better to say what actually is the case. And also don't use sort of teaser headlines that, you know, that might reinforce the false belief if somebody doesn't bother to click through.
Does Rob Ferret really like cake? Like that kind of teaser question?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then another strategy that a lot of fact checkers use is to have rating systems like the Pinocchio scale that the Washington Post uses or PolitiFact's Truthometer. The advantage of those is that they're very memorable. And so they can make fact-checking more effective in that way, make it easier for people to sort of quote them and for people to remember them. The disadvantage is that they, you know, they invite a lot of sort of hostile reactions. And then if fact-checkers ever make a mistake, you know, their critics really let them have it.
talking about fact-checking in the media with Lucas Graves, associate professor of the school at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He's the author of a book on political fact-checking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And Lucas, we've mentioned the partisanship that's out there, and it seems like out in the wild, fact checks bounce around online, and you're likely to see one that you agree with and that debunks the candidate who you already knew was wrong. Do we just turn these into another form of political football ultimately?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point that Glenn made that, you know, people usually don't encounter fact checks by going to a fact checking site and sort of reading carefully through the last, you know, through the last 20 articles they posted is a really important one. We mostly encounter these when they're shared with us, or when we read them, you know, quoted in a favorable news outlet or a favorite pundit, and so we are more likely to run into fact checks that we agree with. At the same time, you know, these fact checkers do really important work in sort of trying to correct the record, trying to establish some common baseline so that journalists and pundits and politicians, you know, who want to get things right, and members of the public have a place to turn to get sort of, you know, answers about what the best evidence supports. Now, fact checkers are always, you know, that they're only as good as the experts that they consult. But it is really valuable to have somebody out there, you know, trying to settle these debates and trying to show us, you know, what's likely to be true and what isn't.
Go back to our callers now. Brendan is with us in Madison. Brendan, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
So I had a question for the fact checker guy. So with the rise of fact checking and considering there's already so many people that think, you know, all fact checking is biased against the person they like that just got fact checked. Do you think that, like, fact checking, I'll see a fact check on like an Onion, a post from the Onion or something like that, or like something that's clearly a joke, clearly not intended to be perceived as true. Do you think fact checking that is like overly fact checking ultimately harmful, or is it just important to fact check any information that comes?
Oh, are you saying like maybe it amplifies things that if it hadn't been for the fact check, most of us might not have seen it anyway?
Yeah. Or people see a fact check on something that was clearly like a joke from the Onion and not supposed to be intended as true. People say, okay, all these fact checkers are, you know, they're just liberals trying to say everything's not true.
Gotcha. Thanks, Brendan. Thanks for the clarification too. Lucas, I guess frivolous or unnecessary fact checking, say from a satire site in this case.
Yeah, actually it's a really interesting question. And, you know, Glenn's not with us anymore, but having talked to a lot of the fact checkers, I know that they make an effort not to check, you know, things that are satire or that are jokes. If they do that, they might do it sort of whimsically, also in a joking manner. So they'll make clear that, you know, that they weren't taking the claim seriously, but they decided to check it anyway, you know, if it turns out to be interesting. And it's also true that they try not to check claims that haven't gotten a lot of circulation yet, because there is a danger that they'll end up amplifying them. You know, they don't want to be responsible for introducing a false claim to a much wider audience. So when fact checkers are deciding what to check, when they're prioritizing claims, they always look for the sort of most serious claims and for the ones that have already gotten a lot of exposure, either because they went viral online or because they're being repeated by some well-known political figure like the president.
In our last few moments, Lucas, I mean, this is a fairly recent rise of this discreet fact checking in the media. Is it here to stay, at least in the short and medium run?
I think it's definitely here to stay. There was some question about that maybe 15 years ago when these sites were first appearing. But now they're very well established across the United States. You know, the numbers continue to grow, and not just in the United States, they're growing globally. So whereas, you know, a decade, there were maybe a few dozen of these dedicated fact-checking operations around the world, now there are upwards of 300. And, you know, they're in more than 100 countries, more than 160 countries, actually, I think. And they're really becoming, you know, a recognized institution We see that fact checkers have partnerships, for instance, with Facebook, so that they help to, you know, these independent fact checkers help to find false claims on social media sites. A lot of them have partnerships with TikTok now. Google draws on their work when it's deciding, you know, what kind of information to surface. So they really are becoming pretty well established. And I don't think they're going away anytime soon.
Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Good to talk to you.
That's Lucas Graves, associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, author of the book Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism. We also heard from Glenn Kessler, head of the Fact Checker at the Washington Post, looking at fact-checking in today's political media. Coming up next, it's news. Then supply chains are still course-correcting from the disruption of the pandemic, and consumers are ready to buy as vaccinations go up. We'll find out what it all means for inflation. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.